This week, we discuss one of the Bible's best-known stories, that of Moses and the burning bush. Our passage will be Exodus chapter 2, verse 23, through chapter 4, verse 17. As usual, you can read the passage for yourself. When we last left our hero Moses, he was living as a fugitive in the foreign land of Midian. Our first verse in today's passage informs us that Pharaoh died in that time. Since he was the man seeking to kill Moses, it seems reasonable that Moses is now safe to return to Egypt. In ancient times, the statute of limitations, if we may draw a rough comparison, expired with the aggrieved party. So Pharaoh was angry, but now he's dead. He's not so angry anymore. And probably no one else will remember or care that Moses killed that slave master. Pharaoh's death, however, did not end the slavery of the Hebrews. In fact, we get the sense that their suffering may have only gotten worse after his death. Before, their life was bitter, but now they are groaning under the weight of it and calling to God for help. And God hears them. For those of you who missed Genesis, God has a special relationship with these people. He promised their grandfathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that their children would live in the promised land of Canaan. He hasn't forgotten that promise. Verse 25 has one particularly powerful sentence in it. Ve'yideh Elohim. God knew. God knew their sufferings. God knew the injustice of it all. God knew that they should have, could have, and would have better. And God knew how to give it to them. God knew. And so now an amazing thing is going to happen. God is going to manifest himself and speak. It is truly amazing because it is so rare. We have it recorded that God has, to this point in Scripture, spoken to only a handful of people over the course of a few thousand years, and no one has heard from him at all in centuries. For many Hebrews trapped in generations of needless suffering, it would probably have been easier to believe that there is no God than it would be to believe that God is going to appear and speak to someone. But he will do just that. He will appear to Moses, of all people. Moses isn't expecting it. He's just wandering with Jethro's sheep near, as the passage puts it, the mountain of God, Horeb. This is the first that we have heard of a mountain of God, and I suppose this was the first that Moses heard of it as well. Now, at first glance, it may appear that this mountain has the proper name Horeb. However, the word Horeb means desert, so while the mountain will be called Horeb at times, as if it is a proper name, it might be better for us to think of it as the mountain of God in the desert. Often this mountain of God will be called by the proper name Mount Sinai. Even that name is not especially specific, because Sinai is really a mountainous region more than it is one specific mountain. It is clear, though, throughout the scriptures that these names are used to refer to the same place, so don't get confused when you hear Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. We're talking about the same mountain, that being the mountain of God. Now, the exact location of the mountain of God is unknown. There is a mountain on the Sinai Peninsula, which is today called Mount Sinai, and which may be the mountain that Moses ascended in this narrative, but we can't really be certain if that is the same location. There are plenty of mountains nearby that could also have been the place. There is, to my knowledge, no mention of Mount Sinai in Scripture after the time of Elijah, which gives any indication of anyone going there or knowing exactly where it is, so the exact location has probably been lost for some 3,000 years now. Whatever its location, Moses was there, and while he was there, he saw a burning bush. The sight of a bush burning for seemingly no reason must have been interesting in itself. But this bush in the wilderness didn't just burn, it kept burning and burning without being consumed. I often wonder if the bush was burning in a conventional sense. Obviously, fire is the light, heat, and remnants of a chemical reaction taking place in some fuel, and as that chemical reaction goes on, there will be less and less fuel to continue to react. So if this is a plain old fire, then the miracle here is a bush which is continually regenerating fresh fuel that can be consumed. My guess, though, is that this is not a fire like any we've seen before. It may have just been some sort of dazzling light display that resembled a fire closely enough that it can accurately be described as burning. I suppose we can't really know exactly what it was, but the point is that the light of the flame kept flickering in the distance, and since it didn't burn out, Moses was intrigued, and so, with the fire, God beckoned him to take a closer look. Incidentally, chapter 3, verse 2 says that the angel of the Lord has appeared to Moses in the bush. But the passage will make clear in chapter 3, verse 4, that this is Jehovah himself. For more information on the angel of the Lord, you can look at a message on that topic, published July 17, 2016. That message touches on a variety of scriptures, so we have it indexed here in Exodus and also in several other books. As Moses gets closer, God calls to him from within the bush, telling him to take off his sandals because he is standing on holy ground. There is only one other person in the Bible who is ever exhorted to remove his sandals on holy ground. That person is Joshua. In Joshua chapter 5, that incident occurred near Jericho when Joshua spoke to the commander of Jehovah's army. Now, we might suppose that Mount Sinai, called the Mountain of God, and the place where God gave the Ten Commandments is a particularly holy place, but it seems odd to think that the outskirts of Jericho might also be particularly holy. From that, we derive that there is nothing particularly holy about the place except for the fact that God is manifest there. It is my estimation that no one piece of ground is any holier than another, but if God is in the place, then that makes it holy. The question also arises as to why one would need to take his sandals off because he is in a holy place. I've read different ideas on this. I've heard it said, for instance, that the sandals made of leather were dead carcasses and that one shouldn't wear dead things around God. I find that to be a little unlikely as an answer, though. God made the first clothes from animal skins, and it seems like he's fine with animal sacrifices, so I don't know why he'd have a problem with dead animal sandals. A solution that seems much more reasonable to me is that this was a sign of respect common in the culture at the time. Sandals get dirty. When entering a house, people normally take them off. When entering a temple in particular, one would need to take them off. I have read that this was the custom of the ancient Egyptians and is still the custom in the East, though I can't verify that myself. One cultural practice I can verify from my own experience is that showing the bottom of one's foot or shoe is still considered to be a grave disrespect in the Near East. It is likely that Moses understood this as a way to show some respect, and it was respect that God demanded. After asking Moses to remove his sandals, God identifies himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, so far as I know, there was no indication that one should fear looking at God in the book of Genesis, but Moses, on finding out to whom he is speaking, becomes afraid to do that. Even if he hadn't been given a previous directive not to look on God, it is certainly a reasonable fear, and one which I must presume Moses felt because God's presence rightly inspired it. So with Moses' shoes off and face covered, God delivers his message. I hear my people crying. I see their misery, and I'm going to bring them out of Egypt and into the promised land. The land is, for the first time, described here as a land flowing with milk and honey. That is a common descriptor of the prosperity offered by the Promised Land. We will see it throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, but it is particularly common here in the remainder of the Torah. God's command to Moses is a bit more comical to me. Having recounted that he has seen the people suffering and intends to rescue them, God then says to Moses in chapter 3, verse 10, quoting from the NIV, "So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." On hearing those orders, I believe I'd be scratching my head in confusion and my mouth would be hanging open in shock. I'd have more than a few questions, the first of which would be, how? Like what, I'm just supposed to walk into the courts of the world's greatest superpower and demand that they give up all their free labor, just like that? No other directions or anything? I mean, God said go. If Moses hadn't interjected, I suppose that God wouldn't have told him anything else at all. Just go get my people out of Egypt for me. Following that order would have taken a pretty incredible leap of faith. Moses, who is evidently just as incredulous as I am, gets about the same idea and asks, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? It is a fair question. Moses, on his own, certainly could not have brought the Hebrews out of Egypt. God answers the fair question, though, with a fair answer. God declares that he will be with Moses. Suddenly, the how becomes clear. Moses will not be bringing the people out of Egypt so much as he will be directing the course of events while God does all the heavy lifting. God assures Moses that this will be done, and he provides Moses with a sign. This sign is the prediction of a future event, namely that the Israelites will go to Mount Sinai to worship God after they are freed. When that happens, Moses will know for certain that it was God who brought the people out. Moses maintains a dose of skepticism, and he starts asking more questions. The first question is, if I'm going to tell the people you sent me, I'm going to have to know your name. What is it? Well, that's another good question. At this point, it's been so long since anyone heard from God that they have evidently forgotten his name. Anyone who talks to God ought to be able to prove it by, at the very least, knowing whom he talked with. Moses would look like a liar if he showed up and couldn't confidently declare who sent him. Now God gives his name. It is four letters, Yod, He, Vav, He, which we transliterate into English as Jehovah. Look forward to a message specifically on the name. We don't have time to cover it today. But after giving his name, God tells Moses to deliver the message he has just heard to the elders of Israel, and to then take the elders to Pharaoh. When they get there, they are to ask for a 3-day vacation, so that they can go make sacrifices in the wilderness. My guess here is that the 3-day journey is just a ruse. If Pharaoh had let them go into the wilderness for 3 days, they would surely just keep going and never come back. It would take a pretty incredible force to corral all those people and return them to Egypt by force once they were gone. God, who has preplanned everything from the beginning, knows, however, that Pharaoh won't take the bait, and he will then use Pharaoh's refusal to allow the people to worship as a jumping-off point for punishing Pharaoh so severely that he'll end up letting the people go for good. As a matter of fact, by the end of it, the Egyptians will be so eager to have Israel go that they'll give them silver, gold, and clothes on the way out the door. Okay, so now they have a plan. Get the elders on board, ask Pharaoh to let the people go, and then God will smite the Egyptians until they're paying Israel to leave. But Moses still has his doubts. There's a lot that could go wrong here. What if the elders don't believe Moses when he speaks to them? After all, saying God's name doesn't prove that he got it all from God. Maybe he just made the name up. So God gives Moses 3 signs. First, if anyone refuses to believe him, he can throw his staff on the ground and it will miraculously turn into a live snake. He can then take it by the tail and turn it back into a staff. If they won't believe that, he can put his hand inside his cloak. He will then pull it out, and it will be leprous. On putting it back into the cloak, the leprosy will disappear. If they don't believe even that, Moses can take the water from the Nile, and when he pours it on the ground, it will turn to blood. So God gave Moses those 3 miraculous signs to prove that God had sent him. He won't end up needing them all, but they're good to have in his back pocket anyway. Now, at this point, we should get something straight that we've been dancing around but haven't spoken to specifically before. Moses doesn't really want to go do this. God told him to go to Pharaoh, and he wants no part. All these questions have seemed reasonable so far, but really they're Moses' oh-so-polite way of trying to back out. Me? Go to Egypt? Let the people go? Oh, no, not me. If I do, who am I going to say sent me? How am I going to prove that I spoke to you? Every time Moses asks a question, he's hoping God will notice that he's not interested in the job and will back off. But God doesn't really do things that way. He keeps coming up with answers for unanswerable questions, and he keeps giving Moses those answers when Moses would really rather not have them. Now it all starts to become a little more obvious. Moses next tries to excuse himself outright by saying that he is a poor speaker. At first he wanted God to let him off the hook because there was no plan, but now that there's a good plan, he's trying to convince God that he can't be the one to do it. Moses' request gives us an indication that he has some sort of speech impediment, the nature of which is unknown, but God will have no part of that excuse. And it is a silly excuse when you think of it. Moses is talking to an all-powerful being, but complaining that he doesn't have enough power to get the job done. God reminds Moses that he made the human mouth, that he has power over men's senses and capabilities, and that he will help Moses say whatever needs to be said. So having run out of polite excuses, Moses decides to get blunt about this, saying in verse 13, "Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else." Well, no more beating around the burning bush with that one, but at least he asked nicely. At this request, God becomes angry. He's already told Moses to go. He's told him what to do. He's told him how to prove himself. He's even offered him divine assistance, and yet Moses still insists on having someone else do it. Despite his anger, God agrees to Moses' request, in part. God will speak to Moses, and Moses will speak to his brother, Aaron, who is a better speaker. Aaron will then deliver the message to the people. And with that, God gives Moses his staff and sends him on his way. I have two lessons today. First, God has his own timetable. I don't want to overemphasize this point because it is one that I have made more than once before, but God shows up when and where and how he wants to show up. When we read the Bible, it might seem to us that God is always up to something. The Bible is 1,000 or so pages, and everywhere we look, God seems to be interacting with people, so it is natural to wonder why we don't see more overt manifestations of God today. That question has led many to claim that there is no God simply because they haven't seen him themselves. What they fail to realize is the time frame during which all of these events take place. Based on the example we find in Scripture, our expectation is that God only makes a manifest appearance to a handful of people in a few instances over the course of thousands of years. The burning bush was an extraordinary event with few scriptural parallels. Just because you don't see a similar event in your own lifetime doesn't mean that God isn't at work in the world. Truly, 2,000 years without any particularly overt interactions from God is what we should expect of him, based on the scriptural example. And besides that, the whole idea of deciding whether or not there is a God based on whether or not you have personally experienced him is a little self-centered, isn't it? When a person says, "There is no God," just because we haven't seen him for a while, that person carries around the presupposition that God is somehow duty-bound to appear and make himself known. God has no such burden to prove himself. We are the creatures, and God is the creator. We are bound to believe, but he is not bound to prove. And it isn't up to us to decide whether or not there is a God, as if we are the judge. The facts are the facts, whether or not we see evidence of them or agree with them. The world doesn't revolve around us, and it doesn't depend on us. The facts are stubborn things. And not only this, but we are fallen sinners. God doesn't owe us anything at all. And the fact that he has appeared as much as he has is a wonder. We don't deserve for him to show up and help us with anything, but he still does. Even if it takes time, God will make his appearance on behalf of his chosen people, and we should be thankful when it happens instead of ungrateful when it doesn't. Second, God deserves our obedience, and we can obey. God told Moses to go, and Moses was quick to ask questions. He wanted to know all the details about how he could accomplish what God sent him to do. He made excuses based on his personal weaknesses. He did everything he could to get out of what God had for him until God was finally angry with him for it. Often, modern believers are exactly the same way. Now, it isn't the same for us in that we don't have God appearing before us and giving us commands that are unique to our lives, but we do have God's commands recorded for us in Scripture, and these words are every bit as pertinent as the words which God spoke directly to Moses. We have a good many commands from God about how we should live, but all too often there are excuses made for those who don't want to do what God says we should do. We hear, "I can't do it. It's too hard to stop sinning." We hear, "How does God expect me to do these things in a society that doesn't accept them?" And sometimes, when there's no more beating around the bush to be done, we hear the real crux of the matter, which is, "I'm not going to do what God says because I don't want to." Those excuses are just like the ones that Moses made, and God is just as angry for us when we make them as he was angry with Moses on the day that he did. So listen, believer, it isn't too hard for you to do the right thing. What does 1 Corinthians 10:13 say? I'll read it from the ESV. "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it." You see, Moses was given a challenge that he thought he could not endure. But this common statement is true. If God will bring you to it, God can bring you through it. We know that if the God who made the human mouth can help Moses speak, then the God who made every part of the man can give man the strength to do all things. So then, let us not make the same error that Moses made in this case. Let us instead stand strong in Jehovah our God and do those things that he wants us to do without making excuses. So then, Moses, once a wandering fugitive in the desert, has become a man with an unlikely mission. God has appeared to him and has given him his marching orders, and from the encounter we learn that we too can have access to the omnipotence of God to do his will. I pray that we will do it. Next week, Moses returns to Egypt. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.